Sweet Spot listeners, we have an incredible deal on a new product from one of our favorite companies, ShotScope. You know that if you listen to this show, Adam and I are big on strategy and tracking stats like strokes gained. ShotScope has just released their new V5 GPS watch. There are tons of upgrades like full color maps of each hole, GPS distances to hazards, layup points, and doglegs, and more importantly, dynamic yardages to the front, middle, and back of every green. You're also going to get 16 of their second generation shot tracking tags that will automatically track all of your shots. That way, you're going to get access to over 100 statistics on their online portal, and you'll be able to see your strokes gained and handicap benchmarking against other golfers. So if you want to make a plan to improve, you can clearly see which part of your game needs the most help, and more importantly, the whys. The best part about ShotScope is that there are no ongoing fees for using their stat tracking portal. So now for our deal. We are giving Sweet Spot listeners in the US and Canada a $70 discount. Yes, you heard that correctly. That brings the price of the watch down to $179.99. All you have to do is go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT, that's one word, at checkout. Once again, go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT for your $70 discount. Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from Practical Golf, and as always, I'm joined by...
Adam from AdamYoungGolf.com.
So today we're going to do a little something different. We're going to do like a mailbag episode. We've been getting a lot of great questions on Twitter, through email.
Don't lie, we've run out of ideas already.
Episode 10, we're out. Episode 10, we're done. So we went to our audience and we're like, please give us material. So in this episode, we're going to tackle three, potentially four questions based on how long Adam and I yap about each of these, which, as many of you listen to us know, could go on forever. So we're going to go through these and give you our opinions. I think they're all relevant topics to everyone who's listening to this. What do you think, Adam? You think these are going to be good ones?
Yeah, definitely. I was going to say let's go through the topics before we do it, but nah, let's keep it a secret so people are forced to listen.
Exactly. I want people tuned in, ready to go on every question. So let's just stop with the filler stuff. Let's get to it. The first question, I think someone slid into my DMs with this question on Twitter. I thought it was such a good one that I wanted it to be on this episode. Here it is. How do you balance trying to fix your swing in a round versus accepting variance? And this is a good one because this has come up on multiple episodes when Adam and I are talking about how to become a better golfer, you need to adjust on the fly with what you're seeing on the course. But then the flip side to that is, well, how much adjusting do you do? You don't want to constantly feel like you're changing too much. So this is not an easy question. I think we'll try and give each of our versions of the answer. Why don't you kick us off here, Adam? What's your first thought on this versus trying to fix your swing versus accepting what is a reasonable variance in golf shots?
I'd say that's the only disadvantage to increased knowledge and awareness on this type of stuff is that, yes, you go through these different stages, right? As a beginner, you haven't got a clue what to fix. So you have a bad pattern, you're just stuck with it. But then over time, you start to learn how to change it. And then you enter this weird kind of phase where, well, I know how to change it, but when do I change it? And how much do I change it as well? And then you come out of the back end of that after hopefully not a few years, but it does take time, where you know what's a pattern, you know what to fix, you know when to fix it, and you have an improved ability to control the amount. So, yeah, it's always a tough thing. I call it game management. It's not really course management. That deals more with strategy. It's more managing yourself. It's a very psychological thing. So, you know, an example, I stand up on a tee, I hit one shot left. Do I now, for the next one, try to correct that? Or do I just let it roll off my back like water off a duck's back? So, imagine you have three shots, right? You hit one down the middle, one of them goes a little left, more left than normal, and one of them goes a little bit more right than normal. It doesn't matter how much you train, you're always going to have some degree of that, right? There's always going to be a shot dispersion circle. So some are going to be more left, some are going to be more right. Well, if you don't change anything mentally, if you just go in there with, say, a blank mind, say someone's able to erase your mind, then you're going to have a certain shot dispersion size. But if you start going in there and you start tinkering after each shot, so say you hit your one left, and then for the next one, you try to fix that by adding something that makes it more right. Well, what if your next one was going to be the right side of your pattern? You've now made that worse. So I always say that if you're trying to tinker with your swing mid-round, you can end up opening up more inconsistency. You can actually increase the size of your shot dispersion circle. So tinkering mid-round is probably, I say probably because there are lots of caveats to that, but probably not the best option. And I try not to do it where possible. I try to just notice certain patterns and maybe just change aim points. And I have a Tiger quote. Actually, I don't have the exact quote, but I know he talked about, he was in a clinic and someone in the crowd asked this very question. They said, what do you do on a day where you're warming up and the ball isn't doing what you want it to? And he said, well, I try and make a small adjustment before I go out. But other than that, I will just change my aim point. And what he means by that is if the ball is going a little to the right on that day, he'll just aim a little bit more to the left, probably both physically and mentally, which is so funny because most amateurs listening to that, or if most amateurs got that advice, they'd say, oh, well, that's a quick fix. That's a band-aid. That's not dealing with the issue. They said, well, actually, some of the best players in the world play this way. If they have a pattern, an issue, they might not try to change it. They might just play with it that day. What are your thoughts on that so far, John?
So I think probably the most important part, and I know we will go into this in other episodes, is understanding the variance. I think in the episode where we talked about what is a good golf shot, we went through tee shots and approach shots and what are reasonable outcomes. And for example, on a tee shot, you know, we know that through launch monitor data, a typical elite amateur golfer or tour player, you know, if they hit 30, 40, 50 tee shots, you can expect a left to right dispersion of about 65, 70 yards, something like that.
That's Scott Fawcett's information.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So Scott is the one who kind of brought that to light. And it really holds up. If I hit balls on my Skytrack after a while, a decent session for me is going to be about 65 yards from left to right. That's a big chunk. So the takeaway from that in terms of accepting variance is that I know that when I step on the tee, it's okay for me to miss a fairway to the left or right. That's going to happen. Or especially with approach shots. I know I'm going to hit some long in the green, left, right, short of the green. So you have to wrap your head around that part of it, is understanding the variance of the game. That's very difficult to do, and certainly one of the most important things a golfer can do to increase their enjoyment, make smarter strategic decisions, and then just have a more positive mental state, kind of letting the water go off the duck's back, as you say. Where I start, you know, when I say answering the question, when do you start fixing your swing, talking about like some of the skills we have discussed, face angle, ground contact, impact location. If I start noticing a pattern, let's say, or if I know I miss it on the heel most of the time, I mentioned this in other episodes. If I'm starting the day missing everything on the heel, and I see that pattern on the course, especially with my driver, because of gear effect, I'm seeing that left to right ball flight versus my normal draw. That's something that I am going to consciously try and make an adjustment to. I feel like that's a reasonable thing where I'm going to be like, okay, you're striking it on the heel. You could recognize this. Let's consciously try and move that strike point over, using those small tools.
Yeah, you can't strategize for a shank. It's the only thing I was going to add there.
Exactly. And so something like that, that would be something I'd be okay with, you know, maybe working on, so to speak, during a round. I'm not going to be trying to change my swing or anything like that. It's just maybe I'll line up the ball to the toe more or something like that. It's a perceptual thing. But I'm cognizant of it, and I'm maybe trying to make an internal feel change. Another pattern, like let's say I mentioned one time I showed up to the course or a tournament with the pull hooks, you know, left going left duck hooks. That's a problem. And if I keep seeing it happen, then I know I need to make an adjustment. That's a problem that needs to be fixed on the fly. But if I'm missing my targets, you know, left, right, short, long, nothing crazy, you know, I'm not in this mode where I'm trying to keep, you know, making changes, because I feel like it's that opening scene of Office Space where the guy keeps changing lanes in the traffic jam and he's going nowhere. So I'm certainly not an advocate of just continually making changes during the round. So you kind of have to know when to step in and when not to. And that is difficult, but that's kind of what I do. When I see a pattern that is very damaging or extreme versus my normal patterns, then I'll probably make some type of intervention.
Yeah, I suppose you just have to be a master of knowing when it's a pattern and when it's an anomalous result. I almost couldn't say that. So a random result. So yeah, looking at patterns, I have a kind of DEFCON system. So I would say in the middle of a round, if I hit one bad shot, it's just like, okay, that's not a bad shot. Just don't worry about it. Keep it in the back of your head, note it down, but don't worry, don't change yet. If it's two bad shots and they're very similar, so again, two shots going to the left, for example, or two shots out of the heel, or two fat shots, then I'm going to pique my interest a little bit and say, okay, maybe this is a pattern. Once it gets to the third, and I don't really have a perfect system for this because there may be a little gap in between those. So I may hit bad shot, good shot, bad shot. I would say probably if I hit three bad shots that are all the same bad shot within about four swings, then I would say, okay, this is a pattern. This is something in here. And then I have to decide, do I try to change that? Do I try and jump in, be in the conscious seat and make a change, whether it's just feel-based? Most of my changes round are just like you, feel-based, really simple. Or do I strategize for that? And so with direction, you can obviously just pick different aim points. But like I said earlier, you can't strategize for a shank. If you are hitting heel biased and it's on the verge of a shank, you probably want to jump in and consciously change that. Same for a fat shot as well. You can't, if you're fatting it 20, 30 yards short all the time, yes, you probably could pick three more clubs, but that's might not be the best option. You want to be able to move that low point further forwards. And this goes into everything that we've talked about, is having this toolbox of fixes, right? You can't be on the course and have those errors pop up and then figure out a fix on the course. No, you've got to have those tools available to you beforehand. I know how to fix a shank before I even do it. So I know if a shank ever pops up on the course, I have one, two, three different things to implement. And that's the other part of my DEFCON system, is once I see a pattern, not only do I have things that I can implement, but I know how those implementations change the pattern. So as an example of that, say I'm missing left one day. My first port of call will be to actually just tweak or change the right hand grip. And the reason for that is my right hand change makes a very subtle change to the outcome. It's not a big change. So I can control the patterns by about 3, 4, 5 yards on average just by changing my right hand. Whereas if I change my left hand grip, that has a much bigger influence on the end result. I don't like doing that because it changes it too much. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I wouldn't, and I think this depends on the player. Like, I personally would not feel comfortable, and this is just where I'm at in my game, of changing my grip mid round.
Oh yeah,
that was just the other episode. That's extreme. I think it's we don't have an answer for everyone because everyone's at a different stage of the game in terms of their skill level. And then you mentioned a DEFCON stage. Like, if you're DEFCON 5, then obviously you need to do some triage, so to speak. You're going to have to do more intense changes if you were having, let's say, shanks. I hate saying that word out loud, but you know, an adjustment needs to be made. So, you're trying to navigate this accepting of golf and the variation that the game gives you, and then also at the same time picking up on patterns that are more problematic than normal. Like you mentioned hitting it fat. Like if I'm fatting all my wedge shots on the first few holes, I'm going to need to make an adjustment or a feel on how I'm delivering, you know, how I feel I'm delivering the club. I obviously need to go on a little bit more shallow path, and vice versa. I might blade a few. These things happen with golf, but those are the patterns I'm looking for. What's out of the ordinary? And the problem is that the word ordinary is different for every golfer. That's just something where that's why I think paying attention to your rounds, maybe taking some notes after, tracking your game, understanding your tendencies, then you'll know what's normal for you and what's not normal for you. And then combining that with the knowledge of what's acceptable variance in the game, that's when good stuff happens. But you know, much easier said than done. You're always walking this tightrope of getting one right at the expense of the other, maybe.
All of this is really the difference between a good player and a great player, or an average player and a good player. It's how well you manage your own game. It's the reason why, you know, if you say, well, why am I not a tour pro? I can hit it like a tour pro on the range. Well, it's managing, I mean, there are other reasons why I'm not on tour, but it's managing these things on the course. I don't play enough on the golf course to be able to understand my own game that well. You know, you need to be playing all the time and implementing these changes and seeing what was too much, what was too little, having these mistakes, but being really introspective. And at the end of the round, you've got to go through these things. And I always ask players at the end of the round, what were your patterns out there? You know, some players will come off and they're like, oh, I played awful today, or I played great today. And it's like, well, on the awful ones, great. Here's an opportunity. What were your patterns? What was your ground strike like? What was your face strike? What were your left and right bias patterns? And most people can't tell me. They just lump rounds of golf into good or bad. It's like, no, be less emotional about whether the round was good or bad, and be more analytical about why, or what you need to change, what you need to improve to get better. So as you said, looking at patterns, looking at why it was a good or bad round, and then working on your ability to implement the right dose of a change. It's what I teach every day, really.
All right, I'm gonna go ding, ding, ding. All right, that's time on the first topic. Yeah. Well, I want to do four, and I'm really pushing for four here. So I think we covered that answer. I think we've gone into the answer in different ways in different episodes, but it's a very good question. I think all players should be thinking about it. All right, question number two. If working on a home golf simulator, what should you work on and focus from the start? Both of us are golf simulator owners. I have the Skytrack. Adam has the GC Quad. Foresight, if you're listening, I'm just waiting for that sweet GC Quad to show up. Not that I don't love my Skytrack, but I've spent a lot of time on I think simulators in general, if you can get a good one, not the I wouldn't say the OptiShot is a good one for this. That's more of a toy than a game than a instructional tool. But I think simulators are awesome practice tools, whether you're using it like in range mode or actually playing simulated golf. And I know I've done a ton of different practice methods. Do you want me to start this one off with a few of my tried and true? Okay. So number one, I start off every session on my Skytrack with my wedge distances. So I like to work, you know, anything between like, let's say 35 to 80 yards, those feel shots. And I'm kind of cycling through establishing my feel. Like, all right, I start off with 50 yarders. If I can nail down my distance, I go to 60, 70. So I'm trying to do maybe what you'd call block practice. I'm hitting the same distance over and over again, see how I'm doing. And then I mix it up. I test myself. And Skytrack actually has a feature for this. You can do like randomized target practice. They have a wedge matrix thing as well. I know GC Quad and other ones have their own methods. And then I call out a number like 72 yards, 53 yards, 64. So then I'm kind of randomly trying to hit these yardages. I think that's some of the most fruitful practice I've done on the simulator, because now when I'm on the course, I don't really worry about those distances when I get them on the course. If I have 74 yards, I just kind of access that feel. And that's certainly pay dividends in my game a lot. So that would be numero uno for me. What's one of your favorites, Adam, with the simulator?
I like that with the wedge distances. It's amazing how, you know, before we practice on simulators, we do everything visually, right? It's, oh, the flag looks that distance, let's hit it this hard. So it's all visual information. But after a while of practicing on a simulator, it's almost verbal information. You say a number and your brain can access that. Like if you say to me 70 yards, I can feel it. I'm just sitting here. I don't even have a club in my hand and I can feel what 70 yards feels like. It's really weird. It's
you're like internalizing it. I like the Pels clock system. Mm-hmm. So I just have kind of like, again, I don't know what it actually shows up with if you show it on my swing video, but I just have a feel. Oh, that's my 70-yard feel with how far my hands are going back. That's how I internalize it. You know, some people like to, you know, I think they have more variety in maybe their swing speed or how fast they feel like they're swinging. I just like the clock system or my version of it. So the word for me is I internalize those distances, I feel like.
Yeah, I also use a similar clock system. And I would class that under the feel category. So it's great to have all of these different things to draw upon. You've got the clock system to hit 70 yards. You've got the verbal cue of saying 70. So I'd say that's a different form of feel control. And then you have the visual form as well. And initially, like when someone first gets on a simulator and you give them 70 yards, they will tend to massively overhit it or underhit it. They just don't have any clue. But over time, that builds. And all of these things can come together. So if I'm on the course, I can use all three senses. I can look at the flag and get that visual information. I can then delve into saying to myself 70 yards, 70 yards, 70 yards, and just feeling that swing. Or I can use the clock system. Or I can use combinations of all of those. And it's really nice to have those things to draw upon. And so, yeah, the simulator, working on your wedge distances, is really, really a valuable additional feel tool, I think. But yeah, I mean, the main thing that I would use with a simulator, something that you can't really get on the range, is looking at your distances more precisely. So getting just more data on your average distance, the spread, the farthest that you hit a club as well. I'm not talking about the pull hooks that go for miles, but I'm talking about, you know, a well-struck shot that lands on your target. What was your longest hit? Because that's a good one to know, because if you can play that towards the back of the green, you'll start to hit a hell of a lot more greens. I like that as a strategy.
Well, that ties, I think for me, that is one of the more valuable things of using a launch monitor simulator. And it goes into question number one with accepting variance. When I hit 37 irons or hit 30 drivers, and then I look at the shot dispersion, and I know I've struck them all well because I'm really not under that much pressure. So like when I hit balls in my simulator, like I know that that's the best version of me as a golfer. I can execute way more better because I'm not dealing with the environment of the golf course. There's no pressure. I try and put pressure on myself, but it's not nearly as much as on the course. But what's interesting is when you're done hitting those shots, as Adam suggested, you can see where they're all showing up. And if you're doing it on like a challenge, like Skytrack has a, you know, like a green hitting challenge where you can either do random distances or the same distance. And they have a skills challenge where they give you a score at the end of it. Seeing those results and then looking at that and then taking that out on the course, knowing that like, okay, I can see my pattern with my 7-iron is, for me, I'm probably missing some of them a little more to the left. Maybe I overhooked them, or you can see in relation to the green. Seeing those dispersion circles is really valuable for expectation management and strategy, as well as picking your targets. So that for me has been one of the biggest eye-openers using the simulator.
Yeah, this almost feeds into the prior question, because I was practicing a couple of days ago, and I actually had my simulator turned off. So it was gathering data, but I couldn't see it. And when I looked at the data later, it was really interesting. Everything was left biased, which is pretty similar to on the course. And it was very tight as well. The circle was very tight. Now I know that when I have that simulator turned on and I can see the results, my pattern is much straighter, but it's also wider. And there's a reason why. When I see the results, I adjust for it.
Yeah, you're adjusting.
So if I see a ball go left, I'm going to try and adjust. And that's why the spread is wider. So this feeds perfectly unintentionally into the prior question as well about how adjusting can actually increase the size of the circle, even though the bias of it was less left. Okay, so if I'm not conscious, if I'm not seeing the results, if I'm not adjusting for it, I'm going to hit probably about 5 to 10 yards left on average. I'm going to have some amount of curve. Whereas when I'm being more conscious, I can straighten that pattern out, but it also gets wider. So I have to decide what's better for me. And I think when I'm training, I'm always trying to kind of straighten that pattern out. But if I'm playing, I'm just trying to aim to allow for the pattern that I have that day. And so, yeah, as that feeds into what you were talking about, looking for biases in your shot directions, looking for biases distance-wise as well, looking for your maximum, what your best shot is. Typically, for example, if I hit, say, 58 irons, my best one is going to fly about 175. But my average or my playing distance for an 8-iron is actually closer to 160 or 165. Depending on how well I'm hitting it that day. So my average distance or my playing distance for an 8-iron could be 15 yards shorter than my longest. And I think most players, we can go into a whole episode on distance strategy, but most players play towards their best every time, right? If they've hit a 7-iron or an 8-iron 175, that's what they use for the flag. And that's just not how good players play. So it's all about overlaying, looking at those shot dispersion circles and figuring out what's the best way to overlay that onto the target that you have in front of you.
Yeah. And another thing that I love to do, because I think we're still planning on doing another episode on our blocked versus random practice, but I just think simulation in general is great practice because it's randomized and it's pressure. Like when I play, I have World Golf Tour on my Skytrack. So what am I doing? I'm playing a simulated round of golf. I'm hitting my driver. I'm choosing a target on my iPad screen. And then I'm focusing on what I'm doing. I go through my pre-shot routine. Those are all great things rather than just bang and driver over and over again, which I do with my simulator as well, and look at the numbers and stuff like that. There is value in that as well. But just playing the games is, first of all, it's fun. It takes out the monotony of practice for a lot of people. But then you're also recreating or doing your best to recreate a real round of golf where you're thinking about your target, you're changing clubs each time, you're going through a routine, hopefully. And you're really, you have heightened awareness. Like when I play World Golf Tour versus just hitting shots on the range mode, my level of engagement is so much higher because now I'm competing. I want to score well. So I just think playing the simulation is just awesome practice because it checks off a lot of really good boxes on what makes effective practice for golfers. So that's one of the easiest things you could do is just play the game.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think you cover that well. And I've been doing that recently as well, and I absolutely love it. And there is that pressure element because those scores go up on a leaderboard, so there's a lot of pressure, especially as my real name is on there. I'm not an alias on my account. So yeah, I mean, I used to do TrackMan combines as well when I had the TrackMan, and that was really fun because it was so much pressure. You'd go up on the leaderboard and you obviously don't want to disappoint. You don't want people to see your name up there and see that you can't actually hit the ball that well. And so yeah, it's, you know, I'd get to that last drive or the last three drives, I would be shaking. Now, I'm not a very, I don't deal with pressure very well. That's one of the reasons why I'm not a tour pro as well. But it just having that pressure, being able to recreate that is so important when it comes to transferring your game to the golf course and making your practice worthwhile. And you just can't really get that if you're just beating balls with no kind of outcome. And there are loads of ways you can recreate that pressure, even playing games with yourself. You know, sometimes I'll record things. You know, I know you saw the fade, draw, and straight shot where they're not allowed to cross. I occasionally do this where I'll record these things. So I'm feeling more pressure there. It's like, right, I'm going to post this later on social media. So I have to make sure this looks good. And so when it came to that last shot, I'm like, this is probably the 20th attempt I've had at this. I've got to make sure it's good. And there's genuine frustration when I don't get it as well. So yeah, playing these games, simulating the game of golf is really important. One thing, a different thing that you can use with launch monitors is testing certain variables. So a real simple version of this would be to test, if you can, hitting a draw to the target, and then hitting a fade to the target, and then hitting an intentionally straight shot. You know, obviously you're not going to hit straight shots, but you're intending to hit it as straight as possible. And from there, you know, you do maybe 10 or 20 in each category. And at the end of it, I usually look at the results and say, oh, which one was tighter? Which one was a better dispersion? And some days it's a washout, but some days there's a very clear winner. And that's good, because then you know when I go on the course, I'm going to play this winner, right? If I'm hitting better shots with a draw towards the target, if I have a lower standard deviation, a tight dispersion, then I'm going to play that draw on the course. It's pointless me trying to fade it or hit all different types of shots. But you can even do this testing different focuses. I've said to players, what are you thinking of? And they give me a bunch of mechanical things. I say, all right, hit 20 shots thinking of that. We look at the spread. And then I say, right, now just hit 20 shots thinking of the target or hitting a certain shape down there. And then we look at the difference and I say to them, well, actually, you hit it worse when you're thinking of all this mechanical stuff. And so that's a good way for me as a coach to then convince them of other approaches sometimes.
When you're hiring for your small business, like I have to, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to find the right professionals for your team faster and free. And you can always support us by checking them out at linkedin.com/sweetspot. LinkedIn is not just another job board. It is a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. I know a ton of people who are using it for multiple reasons, and LinkedIn has absolutely exploded over the last few years. There's wonderful content on business ideas, but more importantly, it gives you access to professionals that you can't find anywhere else. Anyone who runs a small business knows that hiring is easy when you can get that quality candidate. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate from LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours. LinkedIn knows that people like me and other small businesses like Adam or maybe you are wearing so many hats, and you might not have the time or resources to hire. It's not like all of us can have our own HR department. That's why there are over 2.5 million small businesses using LinkedIn for hiring. If you want to give it a shot and post your job for free, go to linkedin.com/sweetspot. That's linkedin.com/sweetspot to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Yeah, that has definitely been one of my top benefits of using it. And I made articles out of a lot of my tests. I was doing them as tests, but at the same time, I was verifying information that maybe I was experimenting with on the, like, golfers experiment with all types of things on the course. And it's not a great experiment because you're only hitting one shot. And what I've done on my SkyTrack is I did articles about ball position. So for example, I hit a bunch of shots with the ball in the back of my stance, middle and front, with like wedges, 8 irons, long irons, and then driver, and then posting the results. And with that, you could see a tremendous change in distance, trajectory, ball shape. And I actually found out that because of my tendencies as a ball striker, I de-loft it. I don't spin it a lot. I typically have to move the ball up a little in my stance as the club gets longer. So I can't hit a 4 iron in the middle or back of my stance. It just won't get in the air. And I verified that with SkyTrack, looking at my launch angle and, you know, peak height and all that stuff. Or tee height with the driver is another one. Like, I experimented with different tee heights. And this is going to lead into our next questions a bit. But all these different experiments and then verifying which one worked the best for me. And then the best part is I take that onto the course with confidence, knowing that that setup is giving me the best chance of hitting better shots on the course. That's been really powerful for me, like knowing that, okay, I'm teeing it up this height every time in this position with my driver, and just feeling confident about that. That's been huge for me. I'm about to ring the bell here.
All right,
I'm very close to ringing the bell.
Put this one in quickly. Insert "that's what she said" joke. Can we edit that out? Now we can leave it in. If anybody knows me, they'll know I say probably 100 "that's what she said" jokes every single day. But I apologize if I just offended anybody.
The childish humor.
Get cancelled already. So what was I going to say? Right. Yeah. In terms of coaching, I run these tests myself and I use these launch monitors. So I'm always figuring out how does X change in the swing affect impact variables. So I might run a test where I hit 20 shots with my normal swing, and then I'll hit 20 shots adding more lead wrist flexion, and then I'll hit 20 shots adding more lead wrist extension. And then I look at the differences, and from that I can say, okay, when I add extension to the lead wrist, I tend to hit it higher and more to the right. And when I add flexion, the pattern tends to be lower and more to the left. And obviously a whole host of other things change as well. So that's not something that I would recommend all players do. But certainly if you're interested in the mechanics, here's a subtle plug. I have a lot of these tests in my Next Level Golf program. But just to say, as a coach, I run these tests. So that helps me when it comes to dealing with players. If I have a player who is hitting high into the right and I know I need their pattern to be lower and more left, I know through all the tests that I've run that adding some lead wrist flexion is probably going to get them there.
All right, here's the last thing I'm going to say before we move on to our next question. This is a warning. Golf simulators can be great, but if you have like SkyTrack, Mevo Plus, TrackMan, whatever, that's giving you all these different parameters, do not go down the rabbit hole with spin rates and all the readings. Like, if you don't understand them that well and how launch angle, spin rate, peak height, how they all work together, I've seen so many golfers like go down the rabbit hole where they're trying to like hit certain numbers and they don't really know the significance of them. I would just focus more on the meat and potatoes stuff, like what your ball flight looked like, how far it went, the type of stuff you'd see on the course. Unless you have a really good understanding of all of those metrics, I wouldn't obsess or worry about them too much. If you're working with a swing professional or a club fitter, someone like that, show them to those people and let them kind of decode it for you. Because I just don't want people to kind of make it an exercise and confusing themselves with the simulator either. I mean, it can be beneficial, but at the same time, like, it could be information overload for certain golfers. So that's my warning.
It can get even worse if someone, I have clients who have their own GC Quad or TrackMan. And so you've got even more data there. You've got path, strike, face, angle attack, dynamic loft, swing direction. And they're like, I don't even know where to start. And so I say to them, look, number one, just look at the face strike number. So it'll tell you whether you're towards the toe or towards the heel. Just start with that. If you can then add on things like, you know, noting down when you miss it left, have a look at the face and the path and try and figure out that, you know, try and get wrap your head around that. And if you just get those two, three things, that can go a hell of a long way and can cut through a lot of the wheat. Is it right? That's the wrong saying, right? Always try and come up with these sayings and end up looking stupid.
You have so many sayings. It's unbelievable.
Cutting the wheat through the chaff. I've gone off on a cliff there. You know what I mean. Getting to the meat and potatoes, as you said. All right.
Let's go on to the next question. And this one, we're going to have a tough time keeping this one short. Okay, here's the question. A positive angle of attack with driver has distance benefits, but can this have consistency drawbacks? The reason being that a plus 5, which means hitting up 5 degrees with the driver, is vastly different than an iron swing with a 0 angle of attack, and they're dissimilar. So the person is asking, I think we now know that if you want to hit your driver as far as possible, you've got to swing up on the ball. And then the question is, it's a good question. That's different than your swing with everything else where you're hitting it off the ground. You can't hit up on the ball with a ball on the ground, or else you're going to have some real problems. So this could get into deep plane and a lot of different things, but what's your first stab at that question?
Well, there are adjustments you'd have to make if you want to hit up on it, but I would just say we already see a putting swing as different to a chipping swing. And we see a chipping swing as different to a full swing. So why not just see a driver swing as different to an iron swing? I think, yeah, people are going to make mistakes if they try and do the same thing, right? If you hit your irons, which we're going to be hitting down. Oh, I shouldn't say that, right? If we're going to have a negative angle of attack.
Neutral or down.
Negative angle of attack with the irons. And you're going to do things like put the ball further forward in your stance, get your body more behind it with the driver to hit up on it. Yeah, people can then, they practice their driver over and over and over, and they get better with their driver and they get worse with their irons. And then they practice their irons over and over and over. They get better with their irons and worse with their driver. That's because they're trying to do the same thing with both clubs. If you try to do something different, if you separate them, put them into different categories, I don't see what the issue would be. The only caveat to that would be someone, I was speaking to a really high level player the other day who hits down on it. And he says that he's seen lots of tour players kind of chase the upward angle of attack and lose their games because they were prior very straight golfers, but they hit down on it. And so if you've reached a very high level hitting down on it, you've got to be more careful, right? You've got to be more careful changing that because you've already ingrained a certain driver category of swing that is a certain way and you're successful with it. And so you'd have to, I suppose, weigh up the benefits, right? If I hit up on it, what's the potential benefit? Well, I could hit 30 yards farther. What's the potential drawback? Well, I'm going to hit fewer fairways, probably. That's likely going to happen. And then you can statistically work out whether that drop in fairways is outweighed by the increase in yardage. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, here's what I see on the course mostly. I see most recreational golfers taking their iron swings and using it on their driver, and that's holding them back. That is not improving their games. They're putting it in the middle of their stance. They're hitting down on it, so they hit these low spinning drivers that don't go very far and they're not very accurate. I think most golfers stand to gain from learning either how to hit less down on it or start getting into that positive territory. I think most golfers will see benefits in their distance and their accuracy because they're bringing a pattern to their driver that's not helping them. But as you said, the better the player, the more they have to lose. So if you're a really good golfer, like take Cameron Champ, for example, who's hits it prodigiously far, but not as far as he could because he still hits down on it. You're not going to tell Cameron Champ to start hitting plus five on his driver when he's having a lot of success hitting down on it 1 or 2 degrees. But, you know, if you showed me a 20 handicap who's hitting down on it 7 with his driver, hitting it 200 yards and it's going all over the place, well, I'd say, well, we probably have nowhere to go but up from here, no pun intended. So I think most golfers have more to gain from learning how to hit up on it with their driver than lose. And I'm an example. I view them as different swings, like you said. I don't hit a 30-yard wedge shot the same way I hit, you know, my 4-iron. And I don't hit my driver the same way I hit my 7-iron. They're different swings to me. I have them in different categories in my brain. And I try and hit up on the driver as much as I possibly can. I've got the ball all the way up in my stance. I'm teeing it high. I'm tilting my right shoulder down a little bit. I'm trying to get this thing up. That's my view on the whole thing.
I think it's just separating them out and practicing them.
Yeah.
Just practice it. If you're bad with the driver, practice it and see it as a separate entity.
And I should make that distinction is that I was not a good driver of the golf ball for a really long time. I had face control issues where the face was pointing at impact, hitting it too far left or too far right. So if anything, for my swing, and you can correct me on the D-plane technicalities here, I felt that hitting up on it more has helped my path issues where I know I don't have, if I'm into out with my 7-iron or wedge anywhere from 4 to even 12, I can get crazy into out with my wedges. I've been measured at 12 degrees. But with my driver, because I'm hitting so up on it, it has neutralized my path where I'm really only like 1 or 2 degrees into out with the driver. It's probably my straightest club in the bag now in terms of curvature. So And I hit up on it anywhere from 3 to 5 degrees. So it's been a huge benefit to me, I think.
Well, I hit up 10 degrees, which is ridiculous.
That's insane. Yeah.
And this is the thing, right? I was actually a decent driver in terms of accuracy as a kid, but I was just so short. I've never had any speed. I was played a lot of links golf, so I hit it quite low. And I learned how to hit up on it, and I just made the decision. I said, well, I'm going to try and hit it as far as I can. I'm going to try and optimize launch. And I did. I ended up hitting 10 degrees up on it, which is ridiculous. If you ever see my ball flight, you'll be craning your neck to see it. It's that high. But I picked up a lot of distance. I actually picked up about 55 yards of carry distance compared to when I was hitting down on it. And it's more fun. It's more fun for me. Do I hit fewer fairways? Yes. Do I hit a few more wild shots? I would say so, yeah. But I also hit it maybe 40 yards farther than I did total.
Yeah, it's a net, yeah. Yes. And we've talked about this in other episodes where, you know, the old golf used to think about only left to right dispersion in terms of successful tee shots. It was hitting a fairway or bust. And we now know that adding 20 yards is worth a certain amount of strokes. So adding 40 yards, if you're hitting it 40 yards further, and you maybe miss a few more fairways around, it's still a net gain in terms of strokes gained.
And by the way, it's not always a given that someone's going to hit fewer fairways. I've had players who hit down on it and miss every fairway, and then we do something to make them shallow that angle of attack out or even hit up, and they actually hit it longer and they hit more fairways. So it's not always a loss in fairways for many players as well. But you can quantify. They're always, well, there can be trade-offs, but those trade-offs might be worth it.
And also the way equipment is designed now and the modern golf ball, it wants to go with the driver. It wants to go higher with less spin. That is how you maximize the current equipment. And I know there's a debate in the golf world over, you know, what the golf ball and driver used to do, where it was in, you know, the pattern that resulted in the most success 30, 40 years ago was hitting down on it with your driver because it was a different golf ball. It spun more. It was a different head. I can't change that. If you want to hit the ball as far as you can and maximize the current equipment setup, for most golfers, you're going to want to hit more up on it. What's a couple of quick, let's give someone a quick homework assignment here. Give someone a good drill if they want to hit more up on it with the driver. What should they do?
Oh, I'm not so fussed on drills. I mean, they're feedback devices. You can put things in front of the golf ball. Like,
do you like the tee box thing or the tee before? Like, I know some people have like a tee right before the actual tee that then they don't want to hit that tee, or they put a box of balls in front of it and try not to hit it. Do you like physical barriers, or are you just trying to get people to think about it?
I just get people to do it. I mean, I have those drills as feedback devices. So, you know, if you hit up on it, a lot of players will thin the ball. And so placing a small tee before it and asking players to hit both tees, that will prevent any thin shots as you're hitting up. But just getting the setup correct, so, you know, ball position slightly more forwards. People can overdo that, though. Getting the upper body and lower body a little bit more behind it as well. So maybe adding a little bit of tilt away from the target. So those type of things. And then visualizing. So, you know, using the nail through the ball, and I angle it up towards the sky and say, how would you hammer that? And people tend to get the right body positions in order to achieve that. There's a hell of a lot of good information in our instinct.
I think most people, just based on my observations and my own game, simply by putting the ball further up in your stance and perhaps teeing it higher, this could change from golfer to golfer. I would test with the Dr. Scholl's spray, maybe what the right tee height is for you. But, you know, for most golfers, moving it up in their stance a bit, if you've got it in the middle of your stance, I would experiment with moving it up with your tee height. And then I do that. What Adam suggests is, like, I kind of have my, if you think of a line on my shoulders, that line is pointing up towards the sky. So my right shoulder is dipping down a bit. I'm, and you could see this with a lot of golfers and their setup, especially the ones who hit it really far. That line is pointing to the sky. It's not pointing straight. So those are a few things you could experiment with: ball position, tee height, and then, you know, the tilt of your body. Those are the three that I work on.
One thing I'm going to add to that is one of the biggest reasons that why golfers hit down on it is actually because of their swing path. They swing too much to the left. And sometimes putting the ball further forwards in the stance, they then open their shoulders up. Does that make sense? So a player will put the ball further forward and then they kind of open their chest out towards a target because it's such a weird position. So learning how to have a ball that's farther forward in the stance and tilting your shoulders correctly to get that club to the ball instead of just opening the shoulders out. So as you said, if a good way to do this is club across the chest and then feel as if the shoulders are square at address or relatively square. Don't have to be perfect. But the front side is higher than the back side. So the lead shoulder is higher than the trail shoulder. So if you can get that correct, that tilt with the shoulders and the orientation of the shoulders, then you're in a good position.
Yeah, but I think the overall answer to that question is that I believe most golfers have more to gain than to lose by learning how to hit more up on it. Everyone has, there's certainly examples of golfers who would not do well with that pattern, but you know, that's why you have to experiment and pay attention to what's going on. And I think what we'd love to do is do a whole episode on how to hit your driver as far as possible, because that's certainly a big part of it is positive angle of attack. I'm ringing the bell. I think we're going to get to the fourth question. This is good.
Let's do it.
Okay. And this will probably tie into question number two. Here it is. The best way to gap your clubs, range balls and mats can be deceiving. Can you get a baseline with one club and then go plus or minus 10 yards as you go through the bag? What are the best practices? So essentially, you know, how do you gap your clubs? I think there's a few different ways to answer this with technology, or, you know, I'll talk about the range ball stuff, but why don't you take a stab at this first?
Well, if you have to just get one club and then gap based off that, I stole this, by the way, and I don't know who I stole it from. It was on Twitter. I believe it was someone who works for Ping. I think it was someone who works for Ping. So I'm really sorry. Whoever this is from, take all credit for it. But I thought it was a neat way of doing it. And I might not even do it correctly. But figure out how far you hit your pitching wedge. So I hit my pitching wedge 130 yards. And then divide that by 10. And that's your gapping. So I would typically get about 13 yards difference between each club from there. So pitching wedge, 130-ish, 9-iron, 143, 8-iron, 156, something close to that. I mean, I hit my pitching wedge a little bit farther than that, so 135. And then it's about a 13-yard gap from there. I believe that's the right, that was the right gapping. So, and that will depend on certain things as well. If you're a really low speed player, those gappings might bunch together a little bit more than it would say, but I think it's a nice rule of thumb if you have to, you know, on grass, get that one club and then gap based off that.
Yep. I don't think there's a perfect way to do it. I cross-reference, I use different data points, and I'm very confident on the course with how far I hit each club, and I'll explain how I arrive at that. But let me first talk about range balls, because I didn't experiment on range balls. I spoke with Dean Snell, who owns Snell Golf. He was one of the guys who invented the Pro V1. So I did a test where I took limited flight range balls, normal range balls, and then tested it against a premium golf ball. There are significant differences. And this is one of the problems with, you know, why I say you want to use multiple data points. Range balls are not good golf balls. And what I mean by that is they're, you know, solid rubber core with a cheap exterior. You'll have inconsistencies at each range with the ball, or, you know, different ranges will use different quality. So I can just give an example here of a 7-iron. On a normal range ball, I hit a 7-iron 168 yards. I carried it. A limited flight range ball, it was 156. The Snell ball, which is a Pro V1 equivalent, was 176. So there's a big difference. You know, there was an 8 yards difference between a normal range ball and a premium ball. So, you know, I caution people, like, range ball is a good starting point, but it's not going to be perfect because they're just not great golf balls. They spin differently. You know, the cores are different. The ball speed will usually be a little less. So range can be decent. What I do is I use a combination of my launch monitor, what I'm hitting at home. I have tracked my game on the course using a system like ShotScope or Game Golf when they were in business. So I was tracking my shots on the course and seeing how far I was actually hitting an 8-iron, a 9-iron. So I take a combination of all of that, and then that's how I arrive at my numbers. Like, I know I hit a 7-iron between, you know, 170 to 183 yards based on how well I hit it. So I like to use as much information as possible, because each one on its own could be deceiving. Like, on my simulator at home, I'm probably going to be hitting the ball a little bit further because there's less pressure. I'm striking it really well. I'm using a mat, so it's not really the same surface as the grass. But then if you track it on the course, you know, there's wind conditions, like different elevation changes. So that's not necessarily perfect either. But if you use a bunch of them together, you kind of get a clearer picture. So that's how I do it. I try and use multiple ways of verification, I guess, is the way to put it.
Yep, I'm the same. That's question over, I think.
Yeah, I think I would tell anyone, if you want to do, I think doing a gapping session, like, I know a lot of instructors who have TrackMans or GC Quads or Club Fitters, you can rent time with them and you can kind of go through your bag and hit a bunch of shots and they'll show you where you're at. I do think the shot tracking devices, Arcos, ShotScope, are the two best out there. I'll have a little plug in there. We're still running our deal on ShotScope. The V3 system's awesome. I think that's an eye-opener for a lot of golfers, because you're actually tracking real shots on the course. And the way that these systems work is they'll take out your bat. Like, if you top the 7-iron, they're going to take that out. So they kind of show you a player average. So it'll kind of factor in, everything averages out over time. If you hit 77 irons over time, you're going to get a pretty good idea of how far you're hitting it. So I think the on-course tracking is helpful too, because that is really how far you're actually hitting the ball under pressure. So yeah, if you can book some time on a good launch monitor or get one of your own, and then pay attention to what's going on the course, you could physically take that data too. At the end of the round, like, you could write down how far you hit a shot.
Yeah. I always like to take data relative to how far a person intended to hit it as well. That is very telling, because I used to do it a lot where I would tell people, no, you need to hit more club, you need to hit more club, and no one ever listened. But when I started getting people to keep track of their own stats, and so, you know, they would say, even on the range, I would say, how far do you hit a 7-iron? And they go, I hit it 170. I say, okay, then we're going to play a game. You get a point every time you hit it between 165 and 175. And then after about 100 shots, they don't have any points because they just can't reach there. And so quickly then I say, do you want to change that number now? And they go, yeah, maybe I hit my 7-iron 160. And then they start to increase their points. So just, you know, playing games like that, seeing how many you can get 5 yards either side of a certain number and seeing how much you can rack up the points. That's a better way of doing it. Or even on the course, you know, just noting down if a flag is a certain distance and after you hit your shot is 10 yards short, just make a little checkpoint or write down minus 10 in a notebook. And over time, you'll start to see, wow, I'm hitting a lot of minus numbers. Maybe I think I hit this club farther than I actually do.
So, you know, what's another helpful tool on the course? A lot of the newer GPS watches, like I have a Garmin watch, it automatically shows you on the top of the watch. It senses when you hit a shot, and then there's a counter on top of it. So when you arrive to the ball, you'll see how far you hit it. So I pay attention to that a lot on the course, especially with a driver. You know, just for ego purposes, I want to know how far I hit that one. But yeah, let's say I hit an 8-iron and I walk up to my ball, I could say, oh, I hit that, you know, 171 yards. I juiced that one, or sometimes it's 152 yards. So I'm paying attention to these things on the course. So a lot of GPS watches have that ability now. That's been pretty helpful for me. And I always tell people to pay attention to that.
You just have to be a little careful with the on-course data, because obviously drives could be downhill, or,
yeah,
you know,
yes,
your tee box is higher, or there's a little wind behind or in front, or it's colder that day, and all these things affect the variables. That's why I love the kind of indoor environments. The disadvantage is the type of grass you're hitting off. You know, if you're hitting off a range mat, you can get dodgy numbers. But I actually have a range mat that I've got the fiber-built one, so it doesn't have that bounce up on a fat shot. So it gives more realistic distances from what I've found. But yeah, I like getting the numbers in an indoor environment like this. And then when you go outside, you can use your knowledge to adjust those numbers based on this is downhill, this is into the wind, this is cold today. So yeah, that's how I like to do it. But yeah, you gotta draw from all these different sources of information really and come to a logical conclusion, which is, again, it's another psychological thing, right? It's not all about technique. It's knowing your numbers is key, and knowing how to adjust them is just as the same as knowing your shot patterns directionally is important, how to adjust, adapt, or play for them.
That's why I continue to get messages from people saying their handicap dropped simply by aiming to the number on the back of the green, because it fixes a lot of the major problems for golfers. So we did it. We got all four questions in. We're at our hour mark. Please reach out to us with feedback. We love the feedback. If you liked this episode where we kind of tackled we mixed in several topics at the same time, not to say that we're not going to do episodes in the future that will be dedicated to one topic, but this was kind of fun. I'd like to maybe mix this up. Maybe every few episodes we'll do a mailbag. So keep sending in your questions and your feedback. Adam, do you have any closing thoughts on what we did here? Were you as excited about it as I was, or was this a total disaster for you?
No, it actually, when I saw some of the questions, I was like, oh, these really don't enthuse me. But it was good. It was a good conversation.
These were the best of the best. So we can't, you know, now if we take questions on another episode, the person who sent it in is gonna be like, oh, I wasn't the first. I was second tier questions. But no, we always appreciate people getting in touch with us. There is no stupid question, right? Or no bad question. Sorry.
Just ones that I might not want to answer.
Exactly. Well, some of them are just like, you know, I'll look at one here. I got, what is the quickest way to eliminate double bogeys? I've written 400 plus articles on practical golf to answer that question.
Like, that'd be a long episode.
Yeah, that would perhaps be like my lifetime of explaining that to people. I think we're answering that question on every episode, because that's really what we're doing here is double bogey avoidance. Adam, let's wrap it up. Where can everyone find you on the interwebs?
https://adamyounggolf.com/// adamyounggolf.com.
And you can find me, John Sherman, at practical-golf. That's it. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, guys.